We spend a lot of time in the church and at Apologetics Press, where I work, countering evolutionary theory. And we have to do that in the church because the statistics show that it is eroding faith in the Bible in a widespread way in our country. There is a mass exodus going on from the church in part over that issue. Statistics say that 4 out of 10 of our young people leave the church upon leaving home, and half of those will cite science issues as the reason for their departure from the church. I mean, that's significant. It highlights to us that matters like what we're talking about this weekend are quickly becoming more the premier issues that the church is going to have to be ready to deal with, rather than some of the doctrinal issues we've been dealing with for many decades. We have more and more people that are naturalistic in their thinking in our country, and they don't care anything about things like baptism and instrumental music and those sorts of things, because they don't even believe in the inspiration of the Bible and the fact that God even exists. But we as Christians, therefore, we want to examine the evidence. We want to take time to counter these faith-eroding doctrines like evolutionary theory. But what about our model? So naturalists and evolutionists turn around, point the finger at us and say, hey, you know, you guys spend all this time trying to pick holes in our model, but where's your model? I mean, we at least have something that's better than what you guys have. We at least have a model, a framework that we can use to make sense of all the physical evidence around us in the universe. And creationists can't even claim to have a scientific to be scientific without having a valid model like that. So, for example, a famous skeptic, Michael Shermer, back in 2007, published a book where he tried to make the case against intelligent design and against creation and make the case for evolution. Very influential writer. Here's one of the things that he said in his book. For creationists to disprove evolution, they need to unravel all these independent lines of evidence that he talks about in his book, as well as construct a rival theory that can explain them better than the theory of evolution. They have yet to do so, according to Michael Shermer. He says, intelligent design creationists have no science to speak of. If creationists want their doctrines taught in public school science classes, they need first to develop a science, and then to convince scientists that their scientific ideas merit inclusion based on the quality of the arguments and evidence. Herbert Spencer, who is a famous philosopher from the 1800s, he says, those who cavalierly reject the theory of evolution as not adequately supported by facts seem quite to forget that their own theory is supported by no facts at all. So whenever you only hear one side of the story, it's easy to believe that side, Proverbs 18, verse 17. But it's amazing how often we can change our position once you actually hear the other side of the story on something like this. So notice the second half of Shermer's challenge here. The first half of his challenge actually presented a refutation, a systematic refutation of all of the scientific evidence that he brings up. I did that in the Science versus Evolution seminar that I did here, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. But notice the second half, we need a rival theory, he says, that can explain the physical evidence better than evolution. According to him, we haven't done that. And so this is a real argument that evolutionists are using today against biblical creation. So notice that defeating error is good, that is important, but that doesn't teach the truth. And instead, it leaves an empty vacuum that has to be filled with something. So how do we prove to people that what we believe is right? You know, it does the physical evidence actually support what we believe with regard to the Bible? Do we have a model, a framework that can be used as a way to make sense of everything that we see in the universe, which is what the naturalists are trying to do with your Big Bang and Darwinian evolution? So in this heavily scientific age in which we live, these are crucial questions that young people especially need answers to. The law of rationality says one should only draw those conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. So in other words, you should only believe that what you can prove. Evidence. This is an important concept to God. Notice 1 Thessalonians 5:21, examine everything carefully or test all things, New King James says, and hold fast to that which is good. That's basically the law of rationality. God doesn't want you to just blindly believe something. He wants you to examine the evidence and check it to make sure it's true before you accept something to be true. He expects you to do that, to actually know the truth that'll set you free, John 8:32. So biblical faith is not blind. It's not a blind leap into the dark, hoping that there's someone at the bottom of the ladder to catch you. That would be fideism. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, it's reliance on faith. And they're using this in a modern denominational way. Blind faith is what they mean, rather than reason in pursuit of religious truth. So notice that modern dictionaries pit faith in contrast to reasoning and evidence, as though they don't have anything to do with each other, because that's what the bulk of the religious world around us has come to believe about the nature of faith. But that's not what you find when you actually let the Bible define its own terms. That's not what the faith of the Bible is talking about. Biblical faith is always based on evidence. It's the same kind of faith or trust that you put in anybody that's where a person has proven themselves to be trustworthy. And so therefore you trust them. It's based on actual proof, evidence that a person can be trusted. So, for example, Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 highlights this idea. God has left us evidence in many forms, and perhaps the most obvious of which is the evidence that shouts out to us from the things that are made, the things that God has made. You can look at those evidences, come to a conclusion that God exists, and even come to know some things about the nature of that God without even having a Bible, just by studying the created order. So it's crucial that the biblical creation model rely on actual evidence. God expects us to do that. We have to fill the void that we leave when we counter evolution with an actual model that can be shown to harmonize with the scientific evidence. Fill that void with the true model of our origins. Notice, fill that void before other false models jump in and fill the gap. And there are other models that are trying to fill the gap in America, are there not? It's not like it's just Christianity and naturalism. We've lived in a pluralistic society now for decades. So refuting error, we got to do that. We also have to be ready to teach the truth when that error has been defeated. And that is the goal of what we'll be doing this weekend in this seminar. We're going to systematically make the case for biblical creation from the bottom up. So if a person is going to do that, you're going to try to build the biblical creation model in a systematic way based on the actual evidence rather than blind faith. The first thing he's going to have to come to terms with is the question of whether a supernatural being, a God, actually exists. And then you're going to have to know which God that is. You're going to have to know that it is specifically the God of the Bible as opposed to the millions of others that are out there. And then you're going to have to come to know that the Bible is the Word of God. And then you have to look at, from a scientific perspective, if we're building the creation model, trying to make sense of the physical realm, you're now going to have to look at what does the Bible actually say to us? What does it claim to have happened with regard to key things in history that would make sense of what we see in the universe around us? And then he's going to want to show that that's a scientific model. It's a valid model that is able to make predictions and have a lot of explanatory power in explaining the physical evidence. And then finally, he's going to want to show that it is a robust model. That is, it can withstand scrutiny and criticism. And so this is what we're going to be working through this weekend. So concerning the existence of the Creator, plank number one on our tower, and I'm sure we've all heard a lot of material on this subject, so this will be very much a survey of this subject in this first session. So in studying the created order over the millennia, humans have reasoned through using philosophy and articulated many excellent philosophical arguments that all point to the logical conclusion that there has to be a God. There has to be a supernatural being outside of the universe. And these are arguments which, fight though the atheist might, they continue to stand today as testaments to the existence of God. They have not been disproven. They have been around, in some cases, for millennia. Blair Scott of American Atheists said, concerning the classical arguments for the existence of God, he said, the theological arguments have not changed much over thousands of years. And he meant that as kind of a jab at theists. He meant it as a scoff, but really he's right about that. The classical arguments have been around a long time. They haven't needed to change. all they've done is gather more and more support for them, because truth doesn't need to change. If it's the truth, it's the truth. Why would it need to change? In fact, famous British cosmologist and evolutionist Fred Hoyle, this is the guy that coined the term Big Bang. He said, you should be suspicious of a theory if more and more hypotheses are needed to support it. And it's truly ironic that that perfectly describes all evolutionary theories, like the Big Bang and Darwinian evolution, which are constantly having to be overhauled in order to make them stay in line with the latest scientific evidence. The classical arguments for the existence of God have not needed to change. They've stood the test of time. They've never been disproven. They stand as testaments against atheism. So let's do a quick survey of several of these. The first argument I want to look at is the moral argument, very quickly. Humans intuitively know that right and wrong exist, what we call objective moral value that isn't based on human opinion. So we're talking about right and wrong that we all understand is right and wrong for every person in every location. So what we call an objective system of morality. Okay, a system like that, however, that is above humanity cannot have been made by humanity. And so by implication, there must be a moral being above humanity that created morality. That is basically the argument. So if atheism is true, then there's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no objective right and wrong for everybody. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, said, absolutist moral discrimination, right? So objective moral value is devastatingly undermined by the fact of evolution. So according to him, if evolution is true, in other words, if naturalism is true, everything is totally explainable in a natural way without a God, no supernatural, then that is devastatingly, the absolute moral value is devastatingly undermined by that position. So if atheism is true, there is no objective morality. In February 1998, William Provine, who's a professor of evolutionary biology at Cornell, he laid out several of the undeniable implications of the atheistic worldview in a speech. And notice number three on the list. According to the naturalistic or atheistic evolutionary model, no ultimate foundation for ethics exists, he says. Notice also that he said that Darwin understood that perfectly when he developed modern evolutionary theory. So what's he talking about there? Well, here's what Darwin said in his autobiography. A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best ones. So according to Darwin, if you're going to be an evolutionist in the way he intended his theory to address pure naturalism, and that implies there is no set moral standard. There is no right and wrong. There's just opinion and impulses. French existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said, everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist. If there is no God, then there is no higher being that can give absolute law that everybody is subject to. There's just opinions, and there may be people that are stronger than others that can enforce those opinions on others, but there is no actual objective moral value. But atheists have trouble sticking to the idea that there's no such thing as morality that is above mankind, that everyone should be beholden to. Because I think we all know that there are things that are too heinous not to consider them to be objectively wrong. Dan Barker, a pretty notorious atheist and debater, wrote the book Godless, in which Richard Dawkins wrote the foreword. He is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Kyle Butt from Apologetic Express debated him back in 2009. And during the Q&A portion, he asked Barker if it would be acceptable to rape a girl in order to save humanity from an alien race. So watch him stumble over himself trying to stay consistent with his position as an atheist in the face of real evil. It would be horrible. It'd be regrettable. I would hate myself. I'd probably kill myself after doing it. But I would have the courage if that was the only option. If that were the only option, then I would go through with it. I would pity that woman. I'd pity myself. But morality would require me to take the course of action that results in the least amount of harm. And those of you whose lives that I saved by doing that, you might be disgusted at what I did, but you'd be alive rather than dead. So in that weird situation, which is hypothetical and extreme, it would never happen, There are cases where what we think are right and wrong could be flipped, he says. All right, so Kyle proceeded to say, okay, well, what about raping two? What about raping 2,000? Would it be okay to rape 2 million people? Barker said, to save 6 billion? Yes, yes, it would be, because otherwise you've got 6 billion deaths. Are you telling me we should not do what is morally necessary to do to minimize harm? So notice atheists can't help but talk about morals as though they are objective. This is what you should do. This is what everybody should do. So he's got his ideas about what everybody needs to do, and he feels like everybody should know these things, things that are morally necessary, he says. But that doesn't exist if there is no moral law higher than man. You know, it doesn't matter what culture or setting a person grows up in. We all understand from a young age, it doesn't matter what our language is, where we live on the earth, even if we haven't been taught about this, we understand that there's right and wrong. We know that it isn't fair or right if another person comes and takes something from me that isn't his, that he hasn't been given or he hasn't worked for or had first. Nobody even has to tell a child that. He already knows it. That's not fair, we say. We know, even if we're 3 years old, that if we steal a cookie and our brother does too, but I get in trouble and he doesn't every kid know that's not fair? Nobody has to tell them that. It's ingrained in us. We all understand that it's not fair if we work our whole lives for something and some lazy guy comes and beats us up and takes what we work for. We know that's not right, and nobody has to tell us that. Mankind understands it. We understand if we do a bunch of work writing a paper, someone comes and plagiarizes that, it's not right. Now, we may accept it and we may say, okay, oh, well, that's just the way of the world, and we may move on. But the point is, we all know it's unfair. It's wrong, and it's not opinion to say that. Injustice is objectively wrong. We understand within us that there's a higher law that governs everything about fairness and justice that is above humans and not subject to our opinions. But there can't be such a higher law code that is above the opinions of humanity without there being a lawmaker that wrote that code. So objective morality illustrates that there must be a God. That is the moral argument. And concerning the fact that we intuitively understand fairness and justice, we seem to have a built-in program that governs human behavior. It's interesting to note that in the Bible, the English words that are translated righteous and just can be translated interchangeably from their underlying Greek and Hebrew words. In Hebrew, tzaddik can be translated righteous or just. In Greek, it's dikaios, and again can be righteous or just. And the implication seems to be that what is right and wrong comes down to what is just or fair. So the fact that we've been programmed with a fairness meter means that we have a program that can be used to determine right and wrong in many cases, which means there is right and wrong that humans didn't make up. It's programmed into us. It's not developed by us. So the minute a person admits that there are things that are objectively unfair for everyone, then he's admitting to the existence of objective moral value, the higher set of standards which could only have been instituted by a higher being, and in so doing, he's rejecting atheism, which is mutually exclusive with objective morality. All right, number two, the intuitional argument. Humans are incurably religious. Our intuition tells us that there is a God, and this seems to be really just common sense to humanity, as though we've been programmed to believe. According to statistics you can find, roughly 90% of the world believes that there's something beyond the physical and the need to worship this being, this thing that's beyond the physical. The rest arguably worship themselves and each other. This is not something that the animals do, but humans seem to have been built with this desire to worship something, and atheism can't explain this apparent instinctive tendency of humanity. Michael Shermer admitted, we perceive nature to be intelligently designed. Since the most common reason people give for why they believe in God is the good design in the world, intelligent design creationists are tapping into the intuitive understanding most people hold about life and the universe. So notice that even evolutionists acknowledge this seems to be intuitive. It's built into us. Notice what Richard Dawkins says, it's almost as if the human brain were specifically designed to find Darwinism hard to believe. He said, why, if it is false, does every culture in the world have religion? True or false, religion is ubiquitous. So where does it come from? So you can just see them pulling their hair out over these issues. Psychologists Paul Bloom and Dina Weisberg of Yale University and the University of Pennsylvania, respectively, they acknowledge there is by now a large body of research suggesting that humans are natural-born creationists. When we see non-random structure and design, we assume that it was created by an intelligent being. I mean, that's what the evidence is finding whenever they dig in and study humans. We are intuitively religious. Geneticist Dean Hamer even wrote a book called The God Gene, where he acknowledges that humans seem to be hardwired to be religious, and he was trying to figure out how do we explain this from a physical way. If all there is physical things, there isn't anything beyond the pure material realm, then how can we explain religion from a physical way? And so he hypothesized that maybe there's actual genes that are involved in making people religious. So this religious inclination of humanity is an acknowledged problem for atheism. Why? Why is it? Well, Dawkins says religion is so wasteful, it's so extravagant, and Darwinian selection habitually targets and eliminates waste. So at the very least, you'd expect it to be hardly anybody being religious, not that the whole world is religious. That this disproves evolution. This falsifies evolution. Famous atheistic philosopher Daniel Dennett expounds on the problem of costly religion. The world is populated by billions of people, almost all of whom devote a significant fraction of their time and energy to some sort of religious activity. Rituals such as daily prayer, both public and private, or frequent attendance at ceremonies, but also costly sacrifices, not working on certain days, no matter what looming crisis needs prompt attention, and abiding by a host of strenuously observed prohibitions and requirements. So if evolution were true, then why wasn't religion eliminated? But, you know, humans engage in this costly endeavor, like what we're doing tonight, that should have worked against us from an evolutionary perspective. And ultimately, it should have caused the demise of humans. So evolutionists are going to great lengths to try to explain why humans would be religious. For instance, Dawkins has irrationally proposed that maybe religion is kind of like a virus that's infected humanity, and it's been passed down genetically through what he calls memes. So the idea is that theism is like a virus of the mind, and it tries to replicate itself for its own survival by making you want to go try to convert people. Now, the problem is, of course, the same argument that's used in favor of memes by these guys, wouldn't it be just as relevant for atheism? You know, why isn't that a virus? Seems like you could make a better argument for that, especially since it's fewer of them. Humanity seems to have been built to be religious. It makes no sense from an evolutionary perspective. Kyle has done a lot of work with this particular topic. One of the books that I have back there on the table is called Does God Exist? And it goes into these classical arguments that we're looking at in this particular session. You might want to take a look at that. So our natural inclination to believe that there's something beyond us that we are beholden to and should worship is evidence that such a being exists that put that instinct in us. Notice what Acts 17 gets at. God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth so that they should seek the Lord. He made us so that we will seek Him in the hope that we might grope for Him and find Him, though He's not far from each one of us. For in Him we live and move and have our being. So God made us with a desire to seek Him, to grope for Him, and the statistics prove that. Human intuition indicates that God exists. The aesthetic argument, the fact that beauty exists and that we have been given the capability of appreciating that. See, again, atheism can't adequately explain beauty because that appreciation for beauty, by and large, has no evolutionary advantage. And this highlights the fact that there's a God that cares for his creation, wants to give us joy and pleasure through beauty. So Darwin recognized this argument as a problem for evolution. In The Origin of Species, he said, "Some authors believe that many structures have been created for the sake of beauty, to delight man or the creator, or for the sake of mere variety. Such doctrines, if true, would be absolutely fatal to my theory." Okay, so why is that? Well, because evolution cannot explain how something would become beautiful for the sole benefit of others. Because evolution is about the survival of the fittest. It's about selfishness. It's the selfish battle of the strong for survival. It's not about others. So evolving a trait has to have a selfish benefit, not the benefit of others. So his thinking was, well, maybe beauty wasn't created. It just accidentally evolved. And then it stuck around, for example, in some of the beautiful male creatures like the birds, the male birds and so forth, because that beauty benefited those creatures personally in getting mates, right? So what we call sexual selection. And then, therefore, the ugly animals didn't tend to get those mates and they died out. Anybody see any problem with that? You ever seen an ugly animal? There's some ugly creatures, some ugly people too, right? Like me. The problem is that Darwin, his natural selection only helps explain the survival of the fittest, not the arrival of the fittest. That's the first major problem. Evolution has no answer for how any kind of creature could have accidentally evolved beauty in the first place. So the accidental creation of something that's beautiful that was then appealing to mates. There's no known evolutionary mechanism for the generation of new genetic information in any natural way. Mutations have been shown to not be able to provide that. But new information would be needed in order to create beauty where there once was no beauty. But also notice that natural selection doesn't explain why we have an appreciation of that beauty in the first place. Why do we get joy and pleasure and happiness merely from hearing beautiful music from an orchestra or from seeing a waterfall or a sunset? Sometimes we get pleasure from seeing things that could even hurt us. Like we want to look at the sunset, which can be dangerous and so forth. So while natural selection might explain why something beautiful tends to stick around in some cases, it doesn't explain why we see that thing as beautiful in the first place. Why do we have an appreciation for beauty? And therein lies the argument for the existence of a loving God. He's made everything beautiful in its time, Ecclesiastes 3:11, things that are pleasant for the eyes, Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 7. The ontological argument, a very philosophical, complicated argument, and there's variations on this argument. The general idea is that you can't conceive of a quality or characteristic that doesn't exist in some being. So, for example, if you were to make something up that you've never seen in your mind, just make something up, it's still composed of things that you know exist. Okay, so let's say you come up with a four-headed dragon that has snakes instead of legs, and there's fire coming out of its eye sockets, you know, whatever you come up with. All right, notice that this creature is always composed of characteristics that you've seen and know exist. Heads, snakes, fire, eyes. You can't really come up with anything totally new, something that is not comprised of characteristics that you know exist. So your Star Trek and Star Wars creatures are all composed of qualities that we know exist. The ontological argument says you can't conceive of characteristics that don't exist in some being. They don't exist somewhere. But you can conceive of the superlative characteristics like omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, omnibenevolence, indicating those must exist in some being. Okay, someone says, well, is this just an imaginary being with imaginary characteristics? Okay, so you can reason through that. If a characteristic is just imagined, it's just made up, then it wouldn't be superlative. It wouldn't be the greatest because there could always be something even greater. Well, what would be greater than an imagined characteristic. Well, a characteristic that were actually real would be greater. So a real characteristic is superlative to an imagined one, and yet we can conceive of real superlative characteristics showing that those qualities must exist in some being. And that is the thrust of the ontological argument. Then there's the one that's one of my favorites, the cosmological argument for the existence of God. The universe, the cosmos is here. It had to come from somewhere. Recall that in Job 38, God laid out the basic thrust of this argument to Job. He said, Job, he talked to him about the creation of the earth and the universe. Where did it come from? Who created it? Who laid the foundation of the earth? Who determined its measurements? Who stretched the line upon it? So who laid its cornerstone, he said. So the universe exists. It demands an ultimate cause. There has to be a reason, a cause for the universe. So cause and effect is very fundamental to science. That's what science is all about. You're trying to figure out the effects of various causes and the causes of various effects. Now, if you want to be rational, you're going to accept the evidence, and the evidence says that the law of cause and effect, or the law of causality, governs the universe everywhere. And paraphrasing, it basically says if you have an effect, there must logically be a cause. More precisely, every material effect must have an adequate antecedent or simultaneous cause. So the cause has to precede or come before the effect, or it can occur at the same time as the effect, and it has to have the necessary potential, the necessary power to bring about whatever the effect is. So all natural effects must have causes. Well, the universe, we know that in the universe, we know that an effect has a cause. The planets exist. They're moving through space. They're spinning. These are effects. Life exists, living things. That's an effect. There must be an adequate cause for that. Someone had to cause these things to happen, and yet the naturalist has no explanation. The mere existence of the cosmos is proof of the existence of a supernatural being that caused it. Well, how's the atheist to deal with this conundrum? What cause can the atheist point to try to explain the existence of the universe without a God? Well, today the popular thinking is that the origin of the universe can be explained from a massive explosion from an extremely hot, tiny, dense ball of matter and energy billions of years ago. But even if that were true, where did the little ball come from? So if you're a naturalist, if you're an atheist, you don't accept God, you've really only got two options. Either it created itself, so matter and energy just popped into existence, spontaneously generated, and this is what the bulk of the religious world around us believes. It's basically witchcraft without a witch. Or matter and energy is eternal. The universe has always existed. So let's consider this first option. Could matter and energy have spontaneously generated according to the physical evidence around us? Again, we want to be rational. So let's say that there's an invisible box around the entire universe. It's a boundary layer that's big enough to hold the entire universe in it. So if you believe that the universe could just pop into existence inside of this box on its own from nothing, then in a thermodynamic sense, you believe that this box was initially completely empty. So let's zoom inside of the box. We're inside of the box now. We've zoomed in. And according to this model, no one put anything in the universe. It put itself here. So according to the spontaneous generation idea, you can just stand around inside of this box and stare into nothingness, and given enough time, all of a sudden, pop. Something can just appear. And not only could something just pop into existence, but according to this version of the model, a little ball containing all of the mass and energy of the entire universe could just come into existence. And then, so they say, the Big Bang process began, and eventually, given enough time, the universe expands, life comes into existence, gradually evolves over time, and then you show up in the universe. And this is the dominant belief today, of course, in the scientific community around us. Now, again, you look at the actual evidence, you find some major problems with this, and even the atheists have to admit these. The first law of thermodynamics can be summarized by this statement by evolutionist Willard Young. Energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but can only be converted from one form to another. And this is also known as the law of conservation of matter and energy. So what does this mean practically speaking? Well, have you ever thought about what happened to a log of wood when you burned it? Where did all of it go? that was, you know, obviously a little pile of ash that's left. That alone couldn't account for all of it. So where did it all go? Did some of it disappear from the universe? In other words, was it destroyed? The first law says that in any process we've ever seen in the universe, no matter what process we've ever seen, like wood burning, matter and energy can change into other forms while it's doing its thing, like in this case, burning. So you might see an energy change to heat and light and ash. But the sum total amount of energy that was in the universe before you burn that wood equals the amount of energy in the universe after you burn the wood. Energy hasn't disappeared or been destroyed from the universe by burning the wood, and energy hasn't come into existence in the process. So using more technical terminology, the first law of thermodynamics says that in any closed system, like our box that has the entire universe, so there's no energy coming into the system or leaving the system. Everything is in there. So no one is opening the box and putting anything into the box or taking anything out. The amount of energy within the boundaries of that system will remain constant. So as this chart shows, the amount of energy present before any process in the universe, whether it be wood burning or universes coming into existence, the amount of energy present before a process has to be the same as the amount of energy present after the process. If you start with nothing in the box, guess what you're going to have after any kind of process? Nothing. This isn't rocket science. This isn't complicated. If you start with nothing in the universe before the supposed appearance of the cosmic egg, no energy is going to be able to create itself to give birth to the cosmic egg. Nothing pops into existence based on all of the evidence in the universe that has ever been studied by physicists. It's not going to happen. You're not going to have the universe pop into existence according to the first law of thermodynamics. It has no exceptions, and so by implication, it would be unscientific and it would be irrational to believe that matter and energy can come into being in such a way that the first law of thermodynamics was violated. If you want to believe that happened, that's fine, but don't say that you're doing it based on the evidence. You have a blind faith that that can happen because there's no evidence that says that can happen. So by definition, you have to have a blind faith. You know, I argue there's no such thing as a pure naturalist. Everybody has to believe in something unnatural at some point. The question is which unnatural realm actually exists based on the evidence. And what we're going to see this weekend is it's the biblical creation world that is discussed in the Bible. This is what we learn from science. Matter and energy can't pop into existence. So the first option is impossible. Matter couldn't have created itself. What about the second option? This one isn't really accepted by many people in the scientific community today. It used to be more popular, but it has major problems based on the second law of thermodynamics. This model would say that the universe has always been inside of this box. It didn't have to be created. It's always been there. It's either been moving through space forever, expanding, or if you believe in the oscillating universe model, you believe the universe operates in a cycle where you have a collapse and then a big bang and then expansion and then a collapse and a big bang and expansion, repeating forever like a big accordion. So either way, this would say that matter and energy are eternal. It's always been here. The universe has always been here in some form. Paul Davies is a well-known atheist, physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist of Arizona State University. Writing a New Scientist, here's what he said about the second law of thermodynamics. The celebrated second law of thermodynamics says, roughly speaking, that in any change, the universe becomes a slightly more disorderly place. The entropy goes up, the information content goes down. This natural tendency towards disintegration and chaos is evident all around us. So what are the implications of Paul Davies' statement? Well, in a technical sense, our second law builds on our first law of thermodynamics and says that, okay, even though you have the same amount of energy present before and after a process, some of that energy is transformed into less usable forms along the way. And we call that entropy. And it's an irreversible process. It only works in one direction, which, by the way, is another interesting problem for the atheist, is the whole existence of these laws of science. We'll talk about that, I think, a little bit later. So any kind of process in the universe, again, that we've seen, entropy is the rule. And what this means, practically speaking, is everything is wearing out. So any kind of process we have, an energy input into a process, an energy out, along the way, you lose some of your usable energy. And so the implication is the universe is running down. We're running out of usable energy. And like Paul Davies said, you can see this all around us, can't you? Wouldn't it be nice if you could go to a junkyard and get a broken down car and just wait for it to get nicer over time? Is that what happens? No, it's not, because of entropy. Kids, wouldn't it be nice if your room tended towards order instead of disorder, right? Sadly, that's not what happens. We put tons and tons of money into our houses and so forth just to try to fight entropy all the time. A house's paint job doesn't get nicer over time. So going back to our wood-burning example, when wood burns, all of the energy present in the universe that was present before it burned is still present after, according to the first law. According to the second law, some of that energy is transformed into less usable forms of energy in the process, like heat, for example, and light. And then when that energy dissipates, you're essentially left with a pile of ash, which isn't nearly as usable. And as with the first law of thermodynamics, the second law has no exceptions. It's never been broken. One prominent thermodynamics textbook put it this way: to date, no experiment has been conducted that contradicts the second law, and this should be taken as sufficient proof of its validity. So what does that mean concerning the origins question? What's the implication? Well, it means the universe could not have existed forever, and we still have usable energy. So according to the second law of thermodynamics, if the universe is infinite in age, then it should be totally broken down. We should be at a state of heat death. We should be at thermal equilibrium at zero. And yet we have an abundant amount of usable energy in harmony with the biblical creation model, which argues for a relatively young universe. So notice the biblical model is perfectly in harmony with the laws of thermodynamics. So for example, the creation model predicts decay and a gradual loss of usable energy. It predicted the existence of the second law of thermodynamics before we even knew it existed. So according to the creation model, the universe will not last forever. It'll grow old and deteriorate. Hebrews 1 quoting from Psalm 102. So we're talking 3,000 years ago. You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You'll fold them up and they'll be changed. But you are the same and your years will not fail. All right, so according to the laws of science, specifically the first and second laws of thermodynamics, which have no exceptions, the spontaneous generation of matter and energy could not have happened, and we know that matter and energy cannot be eternal. And those are the only two options from an atheistic perspective. And so the whole atheistic position is impossible according to the evidence. Again, you can believe in it if you want, but don't be claiming to believe in it in a rational way where you follow the evidence to that conclusion, because the evidence forces you to conclude that there's got to be someone outside of the universal box that opened it and put everything in there. Based on the physical evidence, that's what you've got. There's some omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent being outside the confines of the natural realm. The cosmological argument. What about the teleological argument? This one is one that we like to spend a lot of time on at AP. Paul Ricci, who's an atheist and philosopher, he said, it's true that everything designed has a designer. And this idea summarizes your teleological argument. If there is design in the universe, and there is by implication a designer of the universe. Now, atheists like Ricci admit that basic truth generally. Now, granted, they generally refuse to admit the existence of design in the universe, but they concede that the presence of design would indicate that the universe must, if there was design, there would have to be a designer. You can't have a poem without there being a poet, right? A painting requires a painter. A fingerprint requires a finger, right? This is difficult. I know you have to go get a degree in something to understand this. So does the universe, in fact, contain the characteristic of design? There's an infinite number of examples that clearly show intent, purpose, planning, ultimate things that require a mind behind them. And notice that Shermer even had this to say about it. The design inference comes naturally. The reason people think the designer created the world is because it looks designed. We perceive nature to be intelligent design based on experience of human artifact. No, it's based on our evidence. We know some human artifacts are intelligently designed because we've observed them being made, and we have vast experience with human artifacts. He's making a great case for us. In other words, we believe the universe is designed because we know how to follow the evidence. We know what design looks like because we see it all over the place. Even in things we do, recall this statement from Shermer. Since the most common reason people give for why they believe in God is the good design of the world, intelligent design creationists are tapping into the intuitive understanding most people hold about life and the universe. Notice it's intuitive, the fact that there is design in the universe. So examples of thermal design are of special interest to me based on things I've studied in the past. And one amazing thermal system that God created is the human biothermal system. This is the system that oversees how our bodies respond to temperature fluctuations. So temperature changes in our environment and in our bodies. And your body does this through its use of this extremely complex thermoregulatory system that helps to regulate your body's temperature. So let's just very briefly give you a couple examples so you'll get an idea of what we mean by this teleological argument. The entire temperature system in your body, as you might expect, is controlled by your brain, and the processing center in the brain that controls the biothermal system is the hypothalamus. And this is basically the thermostat for your body's air conditioning system. So it controls the thermoregulatory system. And it uses temperature sensors that are like thermometers or thermocouples in engineering. And these are called thermoreceptors, and they're located throughout your body, and they read the temperature wherever they are. So you've got them in your hypothalamus, you've got them in your skin, your bladder, even have them in your eyes. The thermoreceptors that are in the skin are your peripheral nerves, and then they can actually detect changes in external temperature, like in the air around us and so forth. And then you've got thermoreceptors in your brain, your hypothalamus, that are detecting your blood's temperature. And so from all this temperature information all over the body, the hypothalamus is able to adjust its thermoregulatory system using what are called effector nerves. These are kind of like power lines that are used to communicate between your brain and various parts of your body to initiate different kinds of response. A very sophisticated system that clearly shows a mind behind it. So let's just look at an example here. One small, often neglected, but amazing part of your temperature system is the bladder's detrusor muscle. There are thermoreceptors in your bladder. So these are sensors that are taking the temperature of the liquid in your bladder. It sends that temperature information up to your hypothalamus along these power lines, these effector nerves. As the temperature of the bladder drops due to being cold, a bladder cooling reflex is triggered in your hypothalamus, and the message is sent back down to the detrusor muscle on the bladder, telling it to contract. That detrusor contraction makes you feel the urge to eliminate that cooler liquid from your body, therefore keeping your body's temperature closer to its core temperature. All right, now question. Would you have to have a blind faith to think that just happened on its own? I mean, how could that happen by accident? How could even someone have the knowledge to come up with a system like that? The muscle, the sensors, the nerves that connect from the bladder all the way to the hypothalamus. How useful is a partially formed effector nerve connecting the two? How useful is that going to be? This is a complete system that has to already be in effect as though an engineer installed it in the human body at some point. This had to all be planned out and intact. This mechanism shows decisive design, planning, intent, purpose. When you look at this without bias and just follow the evidence logically where it leads, it shouts out engineer. It shouts out a designer. There's no way around it. The natural order and its complexity and ingenuity is simply stunning. All right, we're already out of time for this session. And so we will go ahead and skip. And next time in our next session here in, what, 6-7 minutes? Let's take, what's that? About 6 minutes, we'll start our second session. Thank you for your attention.